What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Now, this forest is wide. It can shelter and clothe and feed a band of good determined men. Good swordsmen, good archers, good fighters. Men, if you're willing to fight for our people, I want you. Are you with me?
When Errol Flynn's Robin Hood starts to feel topical, you know you're living in an interesting time.
Flynn there in the Michael Curtiz-directed film from 1938, a movie that certainly qualifies for this week's top five political resistance movies. That top five and a review of one of the seminal resistance films, 1966's The Battle of Algiers.
It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
We get to cross a big blind spot off our list this week. Gillo Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers from 1966, with a startling combination of documentary realism and artifice, the film stages the events that eventually led to the end of French colonial rule in Algeria in 1962.
It's only taken us, what, a year and a half to get to this? I think that's when we first made our blind spotting list.
We will try to make up for that with a good discussion here later in the show. Podcast listeners will also get the fifth entry and sixth film in our Luis Buñuel marathon, 1970's Tristana with Catherine Deneuve. Lest anyone think we're just jamming Buñuel into this show as we're going to talk about our top five political resistance movies and the Battle of Algiers. Everything Buñuel does is a political statement, and that certainly applies to Tristana as well. But first, we're going to jump right into the Film Spotting top five. This week, it's political resistance movies, and here to help us out is Michael Sosinski, joining us from Houston, Texas. He's a contributor to CinemaScope, Cargo, Mubi, and Fandor, and highly recommended on this particular topic by friend of the show, Peter Labuza. Michael, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Welcome, Michael. Let me ask you real quickly, as a Houston resident, and this being the night after the Super Bowl, did you survive the invasion down there?
Yes. You know, looking back on it, I'm not entirely sure that that invasion added much to our local economy other than some piles of litter, but it all worked out fine. I was hoping for a different outcome. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. So we're going to get to your top five, and we bring guests on like yourself, Michael, because not only do we want a different perspective, but almost invariably we're getting a much more erudite and informed perspective. And that is certainly the case here as I look over your list of top five political resistance movies, because I'm a little bit ashamed to admit there are two directors I've never heard of, three films I think I've never heard of, and I haven't seen any one of your picks. So I'm guessing that that might be more or less true for a good chunk of our audience. So this should be fairly eye-opening. Before we get to those picks, I did want to ask you why this is a topic. Did Peter Labuza just lie and he led us astray here, or is this a topic that really does resonate with you, and where that kind of began and when?
Well, academically speaking, I started out as an art historian, and I was kind of interested in modernism, but over time I became more interested in political imagery. John Berger's Ways of Seeing was kind of an important book for me. Started looking at 19th century canvases and things like that. In grad school, I became more interested in cinema, and my primary interest shifted over in that department. And my primary interest tends to be in the avant-garde, but I have kind of remained a committed leftist, and one of the things I'm most interested in is where formalism and political action or political content kind of merge, because I think there's been a long history, at least in both in activist circles and in film specialist academic circles, thinking that those things tend to be separate or kind of have to be separate. Or that they kind of are at odds with each other. And I really don't think that's the case. So just over the last 20 years, it's kind of become an interest, a passion. And just one side note, I've taught a course on protest cinema a couple of times. And so a lot of the films that I'm talking about, and a lot of the films that were on your individual list as well, are films that have kind of come up in that context.
Yeah, we did send over a list of the movies we were considering, and I think we both managed to narrow those lists down to five, which we'll get to here at the end of the segment. But let's jump right in. What's your number five political resistance movie?
I didn't rank them. I actually just kind of put them in chronological order. So
all right, we'll go in that order.
We'll start off with a 1947 film by Kenneth Anger called Fireworks. Now, this is the only short avant-garde film that's on my list. The others are features. One of the main criteria for my five, because I had a list of about 25 as well and had to kind of make some decisions, I kind of thought, well, they need to be political, but I ended up going with five that kind of revolutionized me in some way, that had kind of affective power that really kind of changed my way of seeing the relationship between cinema and politics. Fireworks is a kind of revolutionary work of gay cinema. Kenneth Anger would kind of go on to be known for Scorpio Rising and some other films that were really more about the relationship between rock and roll and cinematic imagery. But his first film is Fireworks. He plays a young man who hooks up with some sailors, kind of gets involved with some rough trade, and they beat him to death. But in the course of this film, he essentially rises and takes on a kind of Christ imagery, which includes his penis becoming a firework, a kind of exploding firework. So this is essentially the most vicious kind of gay bashing taken on the filmmaker himself, right? Mm-hmm. And he turns it around into a kind of act of defiance, that he will not be beaten. He takes on the absolute pride of almost becoming a Christ figure. So it's a really beautiful film and a really revolutionary film. And one thing I learned in preparing for this that I did not know before was that one of the very first prints of this film in 1948 was purchased by Alfred Kinsey. So it had interest beyond cinema aficionados as well. It was interesting to people who were studying homosexuality.
Yeah, an academic text as well in that context, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm glad, Michael, you put this on your list because it prompted me to finally view it today, which I did for the first time. And it is mesmerizing. It is gorgeously made, as you said, the imagery there. I just loved how it was calling upon some things that came before, like Cocteau or even Buñuel. Adam and I are in the middle of a Luis Buñuel marathon right now, and the use of the focus on the body in these unexpected ways, really reminded of Buñuel. And I think it also projects forward to some of the work of David Lynch, where there's some comedy in this movie, but also an ominousness to it. And that combination reminded me of Lynch. So really, when you think about this being made in 47, it is quite remarkable.
Absolutely. And some of his later films, like Scorpio Rising, one of the ones I mentioned, David Lynch has a direct homage to that in, I believe it's Lost Highway. Scorsese has talked a lot about the influence of Anger. So he really does, you're right, he becomes a touchstone for the later generation. Absolutely.
Anger, one of those filmmakers I am familiar with. I remember watching some of his stuff, including Scorpio Rising, as a film student. Fireworks wasn't one of those movies, but now I'm very curious. What's the next movie on your list?
Next movie, 1966, a film from the Czech New Wave called Daisies by Vera Hitalova. This is a film that was suppressed by Soviet authorities, and it's actually kind of experiencing kind of a renaissance. It's been released in a Czech New Wave box set by Criterion. Vera Hitalova was really the lone woman in the Czech New Wave cadre. And Daisies is this really beautiful and hilarious feminist comedy. It features these two girls who are both named Marie, and they behave as though they are dolls or mannequins throughout the film. Their first appearance in the film, they speak to each other and establish the premise that the world is dirty and crooked and going to hell, so they are no longer going to be good girls. They are going to be bad because the world is bad. And so throughout the film, they are just creating all manner of havoc. They tease older men so that they can try and pretend they're going to be their sugar daddies and get luxurious gifts and dinners. teasing them as though they're going to get laid, but they never do. They break into this party conference and find this beautiful banquet that they proceed to have a food fight. And some people might actually find this rather bizarrely appealing. They smear food all over themselves and throw it all. Eventually, they are killed by a falling chandelier. But they're just trying to be as outrageous and disgusting and non-womanly as they can for about 78 minutes. And the film incorporates – Hitlova incorporates black and white and color, some black and white sections that she hand colors. There's sort of stop motion, brackage-like animation. She does everything as the director to make a bad film as well, bad in the sense that it doesn't conform to conventional narrative standards. So it's really just a rollicking 78-minute kind of feminist revolution on film. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, and we'll list all of these titles and the filmmakers' names on our top five page over at filmspotting.net for those who are curious. Is Hitlova's stuff pretty hard to find if you are going down that path, or is some of it accessible?
Daisy's is very accessible now that it's part of this box set from Criterion. She passed away not too long ago, and she was never really particularly interested in promoting her back catalog. So some of these films remain in vaults in Europe. Some of them are on DVD in Europe. So if you have a multi-region player, you can get them that way. But Daisy's is the only one that's really readily accessible. Her back catalog is a little dicey to get your hands on. Mm.
Your next film comes from a director that we're very familiar with. Most listeners surely are, and his work is very accessible. And this is one that somehow over the years I've never managed to see, despite being a big fan of his work. Generally, it's Spike Lee.
Yeah, 1995 Clockers. Obviously, I could just as easily have put Do the Right Thing on this list. It's one of my all-time favorites. However, I love Clockers, and I think that it's certainly an underrated Spike Lee film, and I think it's one people ought to give a chance to. It's based on the Richard Price novel, the same name, stars Mekhi Phifer and Isaiah Washington. Keitel is in a supporting role. And it's a little more operatic than some of Spike Lee's more recent films, but perhaps not as much so as Do the Right Thing. It's a film that really explores the topic of black masculinity and the question of being hard, what it means to be hard, particularly in a situation of living in the projects. Mekhi Phifer plays a character named Strike, who is a drug dealer, and he desperately wants out, but he doesn't really find that he has a way out. All of the characters really have unusual, or what we might typically think of as unusual, character traits. For instance, Strike is obsessed with model trains, and he spends almost all of his drug money on this elaborate model train system because he's obsessed with trains and he wants to eventually ride real trains and get as far away from New York City as he can. His brother, played by Isaiah Washington, is kind of the straight arrow of the family, but he has this kind of violent streak that everything he does is trying to suppress that. I mean, he's the good family man who's kind of contrasted with Strike. It's a film that some people found a little simplistic. I kind of thought that a lot of the things that may have been simplistic were really more allegorical. So I think that some of the reasons it may not have entered the canon of Spike Lee may just be interpretive questions. It's not going to be something for everybody, but I think some of the questions it raises are really significant, really important for today. So,
well, a bit of a spoiler. I do have a Spike Lee film on my list, not Clockers, and actually not Do the Right Thing either, but we'll get to that in a bit. What was the fourth film you had on your list, Michael?
2005 French film called Regular Lovers by Philippe Garrel. Garrel is one of this group of post-New Wave filmmakers, Maurice Pialat is another one, the late Jean Eustache, who didn't entirely abandon the innovations of the French New Wave, but they were really more in the romantic vein, partly because they were living with the failure of May 68 and their revolutionary ideals they saw kind of crumbling around them. So it made them into a different kind of filmmaker. They, whereas some of the other filmmakers in France were kind of looking to Godard. These are filmmakers who kind of looked to Eric Romare, for instance. So Gorel is someone who has been on the scene for decades and, again, is only really kind of getting his due as a major filmmaker. Regular Lovers stars the director's son, Louis Gorel, and a lot of his recent films do. And this is his one film that is explicitly about May 68. It's a look at the failed radicals of May 68. It's a 3-hour film, and the first 30 minutes are the riots of 68. It doesn't hold that back as a set piece. It kind of jumps in medias res to the events of May and some of the main characters you see hiding from the police in apartments and being scattered. And then they all kind of come back together at their safe house after May 68 has definitively failed. And it's about them dealing with the aftermath of May 68. Some of them retain their political ideals and try and regroup. Some of them feel like what they were doing was misguided, that they weren't leftist enough, or that their leftism didn't take feminism into account enough, or that their personal relationships got in the way of politics, or that their politics didn't account enough for their personal relationships. All manner of post-mortem exploration of what happens when you have your big moment and then it's gone. Mm. So this is something that I think revolutionaries or radicals don't often take into account, because, you know, you fight the battle and then you have to kind of regroup and get ready for the next one or change your strategy. And this is really kind of what Regular Lovers is about. Mm. So in a way, it's kind of, for a revolutionary, it's kind of a downer, but it's, I think, something that anyone who's active in politics inevitably goes through and feels. It's not often represented.
Yeah. And May 68 comes up in lots of French cinema. I'm thinking now, with you talking about it, of course, Louis Gorel starring in the Bertolucci film, The Dreamers, which is set right in the heart of that time period. And then a movie that, until you said May 1968, I had completely forgotten about, but very well could have made my top five, the recent Olivier Assayas movie, Something in the Air, or Après-May, very much obviously about that post-May struggle, if you will. And of course, there's a romantic and coming of age angle to that film as well, but very much dealing with that post-revolution malaise, I guess.
Right. And I think that, just as a side note, some of these films are of particular interest now because some of the things that happened with May 68 parallel some of the things that I think happened with Occupy, in the sense that you've got a movement with a full head of steam, but some of the aims are not entirely clear, and there's not a clear leadership, which is by design in a sense, but there's not a clear leadership to take or assume power. And so then the thing dissipates and you have to kind of decide, okay, well, where do you go from there? Mm-hmm. There are pretty clear parallels with May 68. And so, you know, history can kind of teach us some things in that respect.
Your final choice for political resistance movies.
2006, a film based in Mali by a Mauritanian filmmaker named Abdourahmane Sissako. And the film is called Bamako. It takes place in the Malian capital. And Sissako is kind of a major African filmmaker. And this was the film where he kind of found a sense of humor, in a sense. This is a film in which some African judges and some French judges, some justices and some others around the world converge on Bamako with the intent of putting the International Monetary Fund on trial for crimes against Africa. It becomes a mock trial, but it is conducted with absolute accuracy. There are other things going on in the film, the village where it takes place. People are kind of going about their business, people going to a club to hear a local singer, or there's a family that has a sick little girl. And so we see just what's going on around them. But the main crux of the film is the IMF being put on trial by the African victims of neoliberal capital. And one of the things that makes this film kind of remarkable is that it turns some of the arguments against the IMF and against the World Bank into cinema. These are charismatic speakers who are articulating the best possible arguments against global capital and what it's done to Africa in the last 20, 25 years. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but the turning point of this film, there is an elderly farmer who he's on the dock and he keeps being asked to come forward and deliver his testimony. And he kind of demurs. He doesn't want to take the mic. And then when he finally does, he belts out this mournful folk song that is not even translated in the subtitles. He just kind of stops everyone cold because instead of giving some kind of juridical testimony, he just sings this traditional song of anguish that serves as his testimony. Kind of brings up the whole question of what counts as testimony in the context of a trial. There are some things, again, this kind of question of affect, there are some things that exceed or go beyond the ability to speak in the language of justice and have to be articulated in a different way. So powerful stuff.
Unfortunately, I've only seen one Sissako film. That's Timbuktu from 2015. And it's set in an African town that's under the rule of an Islamist militia. So certainly political in its own right. And it's really quite good.
All fascinating picks. And I'm curious if there were any other films. You mentioned that you had about 25 there. Do you want to list a couple more that were tough for you to omit?
There were several. Probably the hardest film not to include, the one I almost put on the list, is by Ken Jacobs, the master avant-gardist from New York. He has a film, 15-minute film, called Capitalism, Child Labor. And he made the film out of a single stereoscopic viewing card. Before there was cinema, people had objects in parlors just to kind of look at, optical toys. Stereoscopes were a lot like Viewmasters. They would have two images side by side that were just slightly different. And you put it in a stereoscope viewer and it can kind of give you shallow 3D. Jacobs took this card and photographed through video each side and alternates them through editing very, very rapidly. So you've got a vibrating image on the screen that kind of gives you a shallow 3D. And the card is an image of five children and their overseer in a thread factory working on spindles of thread. And they are obviously there under duress. They look absolutely miserable. And just for 15 minutes, Jacobs moves around this image, focusing on different children's faces, the face of the overseer, the overseer's leather kosh weapon that he obviously has to hit the kids in the leg or the kneecap if they get out of hand, different parts of the machines vibrating. And he has this soundtrack that is almost like a machine vibrating. So it is as though for 15 minutes, very difficult film to watch, but we are entering the hell of this factory that children were submitted to for some portion of their lives. It's hard to see, shows up at various museums and things like that, but it's almost as hard to watch as it is to find. So that was the one I left off my list.
Well, Michael, thank you for your time and for your insight. Where can our listeners find more of your stuff?
I have a website called The Academic Hack. It's academichack.net. And I have a link from there to my Letterboxd account and everything I write for other magazines I link to there. So there you go.
Perfect. We will link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. It was really a pleasure to have you on. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
Paris. So after all that great stuff from Michael, we're not going to belabor this top five too much more, but we did put in the effort to come up with our own individual lists, and maybe we'll go through them here in batches. Your number five and your number four, Josh.
We heard a little bit from my number five at the top of the show, The Adventures of Robin Hood. And I have to credit Chuck Canzoneri for suggesting this, a member of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, where he goes by the handle 1SO. I've loved this 1938 Errol Flynn movie since childhood, but never really thought of it in this way as a political film. But of course, Robin's plan to steal, you know, from the rich and give to the poor, deeply political. Plus, you know, this is punctuated by some really great rousing sword fights. So that's a bonus. My number four, I went with the Hunger Games franchise. I mean, I always thought from the very first film, which I like more than most people, that this franchise is going to gain resonance as the years go by. Well, that was before we even had President Snow. Or Trump, I guess we should call him. I'm going to say Mockingjay Part 1 is maybe the most political of
and that's the one that
group.
I actually consider it's the only one I really, really like from the series, and I am a big fan of that
It might be the best, and it's probably the most politically potent.
My number five pick, and I should note, Michael mentioned Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. That is in the Film Spotting Pantheon, so not eligible for this list. A couple other movies that certainly most people would consider that we had to exclude. Casablanca.
There were a lot in the Pantheon.
Yeah, there probably are, but two more obvious ones, Casablanca and a little sci-fi space fantasy film called Star Wars.
What about Dog Day Afternoon, Cool Hand Luke, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Oh, man.
I think you could make a case for all those.
Oh, yeah, you certainly could. My number five, though, is a film you've heard me talk about a little bit here over the years, Josh. Made my top five dystopias, made my top five things from space that came to destroy us, and my top five films of 1988 in 2015. And it's the John Carpenter film They Live, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper, an unnamed drifter who ends up coming into the possession of some sunglasses that show him the way the world really appears. And it turns out that we're being fed a whole lot of subliminal messaging by these humanoid creatures who have come to deplete our planet's resources. Very topical now in that I keep seeing a lot of imagery on the internet where people are invoking Trump and they are putting his face over images that look like they're out of They Live, and we're seeing under his skin, and there's some of that humanoid skeleton. And even last month, John Carpenter had to tweet out in response to apparently a whole lot of neo-Nazis who hail They Live as an anti-Semitic masterpiece.
Oh, no.
He had to set the record straight, even though I can't believe he had to do this. He tweeted out and set the record straight. They Live is about yuppies and unrestrained capitalism. It has nothing to do with Jewish control of the world, which is slander and a lie.
What a world we live in that the filmmaker has to spell out what their movie means.
This is
for
not
all of us.
A pro-Nazi film.
Also, I should say, I think Rowdy Roddy Piper is one of the most mentioned actors in Film Spotting history just because of They Live.
Yeah, I mean, what else do you have to go on? I mean, I was a fan of WrestleMania for a time back in the 80s, but my number four is Bloody Sunday, the Paul Greengrass film. This is one of my top five films of 2002. Probably the closest to the Battle of Algiers of any of the films I considered in terms of style. Putting you in the middle of the violence that occurs when the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association marched in Derry on January 30th, 1972. And it has that handheld camera, very much feeling like a documentary capturing this event unfold, but also in terms of a more objective approach. It's decidedly telling the Irish perspective here, and the main character, if you will, is a member of parliament named Ivan Cooper, played by James Nesbitt. He was one of the organizers of the march, but it's very much a procedural, and it does show us the British side, at least in the form of their military planning for the day as well. So reminded me in a lot of ways of the Battle of Algiers.
And I should probably know the Battle for Algiers memorialist is what I'm calling this one, as we'll get to. Such a great film that I just had to kind of set that aside.
Yeah, that makes sense. I set another film aside about the French Resistance. A Man Escaped is my memorialist.
Yeah, that could be a pick here too, obviously. And we brought up Do the Right Thing being in the Pantheon, so not eligible. My number three film is Spike Lee's Malcolm X, which is political in its narrative, obviously, but also in its very existence. I mean, here was Spike Lee as a black director arguing for a place at the top of the Hollywood prestige system. And, you know, it's notable, though, that only Denzel Washington and costume designer Ruth Carter were nominated for Academy Awards when Malcolm X came out. That surprised me, too, when I looked that up. My number two film comes from our contemporary Iranian marathon that we did a couple of years ago now. I mean, considering that Salesman director this year for the Oscars, Asghar Farhadi, is boycotting attending because of Trump's executive order restricting travel, I wanted to go in this direction. And so I picked Offside from Jafar Panahi. This is the film that follows a handful of women who dress in disguise and sneak into this critical 2006 soccer match between Iran and Bahrain where women aren't allowed.
Yeah, really, really good film. My number three is another Irish political drama. It's Hunger, the movie that introduced me, and I'm guessing most of the world, to Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender and to the filmmaker Steve McQueen. This was from 2008. And Fassbender plays Bobby Sands, a member of the Irish Republican Army. And he and his other prisoners in the Mays prison in the mid-70s, they are telling the British government that they should be considered political prisoners and they should be treated differently and have some different rights. And the British government does not want to hear any of that. So they go on various strikes, including ultimately a hunger strike. The way McQueen uses the prison and its walls, they're a canvas ultimately for him to paint this really full, vivid portrait of human suffering and resilience as well. And yes, a lot of people talk about the amazing 24-minute conversation that happens at the center of this film. It's a single take. It's on YouTube. We'll link to it in the show notes. But Fassbender and Liam Cunningham, as a priest, they come in to have a conversation about whether or not this hunger strike is really such a good idea and whether it's ultimately even going to be effective. And they really get into the morality and the ideology behind such a strike and ultimately the personal sacrifice that's required for a larger cause.
Have you thought about what you're going to be putting these boys through? I mean, putting aside what's going to happen to these poor men's families, you're going head-to-head with a British government who clearly despise republicanism, who are unshakable, who can easily live with the deaths of what they call terrorists. And the stakes are much higher this time.
I know that.
And if you're not even willing to negotiate, you're looking for them to capitulate. Is that it?
Right.
So failure means many dead men, families torn apart, and the whole republican movement demoralized.
Aye. Worst case scenario, it might well mean all that. But short term, out of the ashes, guaranteed there'll be a new generation of men and women, even more resilient, more determined.
Look who you're talking to.
There's a war going on.
This works well. My number two, also Jafar Panahi, Josh, but I couldn't decide, and so I cheated, and I've got a double feature of This Is Not a Film and Taxi, or Taxi Tehran, which came out in 2015, and I believe was my number seven film of that year. But this is a filmmaker who, not too long ago, was banned from making films by his government for 20 years, and yet This Is Not a Film is him very much setting out to make a film, despite the fact that he is under house arrest and has minimal equipment and doesn't have actors or any of the other resources a filmmaker like he in the past would normally have at his disposal. And so this film and Taxi Tehran are both examples where just the fact that they exist at all is an act of political resistance.
All right, we each have one more, right?
One more.
Okay, my number one. It seemed fitting to have a pure propaganda film on this list, and so I went with Battleship Potemkin, Sergei Eisenstein's 1925 silent masterpiece about a mutiny aboard a Russian naval ship. And it certainly is propaganda because it commemorates the Russian Revolution. Also happens to be a foundational work in cinema editing, so that's probably why I bumped it up to the number one slot.
Yeah, very much a movie that needs to be in the conversation about political resistance movies. And in fact, back in 2011 on Film Spotting, me and Maddie did our top five revolution movies. And I, of course, excluded those movies this time, but I had Potemkin at number one. I had Reds at number two, the Lindsay Anderson movie If at number three, Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend at four, and Metropolis was my number five. But those films and that top five was inspired by a conversation we had about the film Army of Shadows, which takes us back to the French Resistance. And Michael was talking about post-1968 in France and the fallout from that. Army of Shadows is a movie that was made in 1969, and you've got Jean-Pierre Melville going back to 1940s Vichy France. And I'm just going to quote Roger Ebert here because he absolutely nails this film. He says, Army of Shadows is not a film about daring raids and exploding trains, but about cold, hungry, desperate men and women who move invisibly through the Nazi occupation of France. Their army is indeed made of shadows. They use false names. They have no addresses. They can be betrayed in an instant by a traitor or an accident. They know they will probably die. Many films have shown such actions. Melville, who is himself a member of the resistance, is not interested in making an action film. Action releases tension and makes it external. His film is about the war within the minds of resistance members who must live with constant fear, persist in the face of futility, accept the deaths of their comrades, and expect no reward except the knowledge that they are doing the right thing. I hope someday I'll write something half as poignant and eloquent as Ebert there. So Army of Shadows, my number one political resistance movie. Josh, any additional films you want to sneak in?
All right, let me name just a couple here. You mentioned Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Definitely with you there. I'm with you on Hunger, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, getting to our Buñuel marathon here. A Man Escaped, I also considered for this list. Selma, a recent film. Children of Men. And Persepolis. That's another suggestion by another Film Spotting Advisory Board member, Melissa Taminga. So thanks for that.
And a very good one. As Michael was talking, something he said prompted the Joshua Oppenheimer films. Those popped into my head.
Oh,
the Act
absolutely.
Of Killing and The Look of Silence,
yes.
I think, should be in this conversation. How to Survive a Plague, the recent documentary about the AIDS crisis and that battle in the 80s, all the activists who were trying to prevent what they saw as this plague, their community just being slaughtered, the gay community and the Reagan administration being completely unwilling, it seemed, to do anything to help them, including even acknowledge that it was, in fact, a health crisis that they needed to intervene in. Medium Cool, Inglourious Basterds, not just the war part, but there's the whole Shoshana storyline, obviously, and the way that film culminates. Rossellini's Rome, Open City, and Children of Men was another one I considered. So we've now thrown out about 100 different films
probably
that people could seek out if they haven't seen them already and if they are in a particularly political frame of mind these days. Those are our top five and Michael's top five. We'd love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Well, I did refrain from putting the Battle of Algiers on my list because I knew we'd have a chance to really dig into it with our Blind Spotting review. That's up next, along with a little Massacre Theater. Stay with us. لا تلقى دارك إلا غير مكترث مدام يسحب فيه روحك البدن فما يديم سرور ما سررت به ولا يرد عليك الفائت الحزن كم قد قتلت وكم قد مت عندكم ثم انطفت فزال القبر والكفن ما كل ما يتمنى المرء يدركه تجري الرياح بما لا تشتهي السفن تجري الرياح بما لا تشتهي السفن مما أضر People keep asking if I'm back and I haven't really had an answer but now yeah I'm thinking I'm back so you can either hand over your yeah. son or you can die screaming alongside him! John Wick is back, and we are back with more Film Spotting. These goosebumps on my arm, I bet you can see them from across yes,
the table here.
They're huge and disturbing.
They tell me next week's show is going to be a good one. The one and only Keanu Reeves as John Wick in that 2014 flick. Next week, in the tradition of dubious film spotting endeavors, like last year's Fast and Furious marathon, that one paid off, at least for us. We turn next week's show over to Mr. Wick. It is a blind cow review of the original. That means it's a blind spot for Josh. It is potentially a sacred cow for me as I have seen it. And we're going to discuss that film and share some thoughts on the sequel, Chapter 2, which opens this weekend. When are you going to see it, Josh? Because I might be available and we can wick it up.
We could do that. I still have to see the original yet.
I know.
I have the Blu-ray in hand. I'm prepared to do that and can't wait to do John Wick 2. I think when we feel like we're approaching on particular pretentiousness, more than our usual pretentiousness, mm-hmm. then we have to throw in something like this, like a John Wick back-to-back or a Fast and Furious.
It wasn't that calculated, but
maybe,
it doesn't hurt.
Maybe this show could be considered a little more pretentious than our other shows. I don't know. We'll see, find out what people think about it. So yeah. Let's follow it up with John Wick. Why not?
I'm sure there's lots of symbolism we can pontificate on in these John Wick films. And I love our deathmatch poll so far. It's a bit of a deathmatch, if you will. We're not pitting two different directors or actors or films against each other, but you basically have the choice. John Wick is, do you think it's a sacred cow? Or do you think it's a false idol? Or we'll give you that third option. I guess I should see John Wick. That's how you voted, right. Of course. And I will say, so far, if mm-hmm. you look at the voting, it's pretty much 33% each.
Ooh,
like it
exciting.
Is evenly split along these lines. But that means there is a good chunk of our very pretentious listeners, 33% of them, who have yet to take in John Wick. And they are going to be doing that, hopefully, along with you, Josh, in preparation for next week's show. Speaking of our listeners, they do love to correct us. And
this
sometimes we need to be corrected. And it turns out I needed to be corrected within the span of about 2 minutes, I think, in the same episode. I noted that I thought it was disappointing that The Handmaiden wasn't a nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. Mm-hmm. And as I was re-listening to the show this past weekend, I heard myself say that. I thought, you know, you really should have probably Googled just to see if there was some story about that. Well, guess what? There was a story about that. Dennis H. from Washington, D.C. He first notes, Josh, that John Wick is laughably mediocre in every aspect. So
uh-oh.
I guess we know how he voted in the poll. He says The Handmaiden
the
was certainly
go down a little bit.
No, I'm not listening to Dennis, though I am listening to him on this front. He says The Handmaiden was certainly snubbed for cinematography, in my opinion, but it was never up for Best Foreign Language Film because South Korea's authority nominated The Age of Shadows. I haven't seen that film, but it really speaks to how terrible and nonsensical this process is. They really need to change it so that countries don't nominate their films or can nominate more than one. For the record, Korea has never had a Best Foreign Film nominee. That's an utter travesty considering the level of cinematic art coming out of that country. And then
that's
it really
very
did.
Surprising.
Yeah, it did all come back to me then because I remember a month or two ago, David Ehrlich posting an article on IndieWire and tweeting about it that was about that very thing, how no South Korean film has ever been nominated, and it has a lot to do with the films they choose to nominate. So Film Spotting regrets that error as we regret another error that I made on last week's show, Josh, involving our top five list, and we were sharing our most anticipated movies, our questions of the movie season, and I didn't bother to Google Mark Boll, the screenwriter, to see what films he'd worked on with Kathryn Bigelow. Turns out he had made two films with her, but they were not Zero Dark Thirty and Black Hawk Down. They were Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. Friend of the show, Chris Klimek, wrote in to correct me on that. He says, that's okay. In about the same minute, Josh referred to Andy Serkis's stop-motion performance. He meant motion capture performances. I dearly wish for you, my friend, that this shall be the pettiest and most irritating email you get this week. I even noticed that one and sent you an email about it, of course, way after the fact, after
yeah,
the show went
thanks
up.
Thanks for helping
yeah,
me out there.
I clearly wasn't paying attention.
It's good to know Chris listens with a red pen and a smug smirk on his face.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I'm picturing him.
That's the only face Chris has. So.
And here's to show how unhelpful I was to you. I looked up. I could have sworn you said The Hurt Locker.
No.
And you were questioning whether it was Mark Boll. So I looked up the credit while you were talking to back you up, looked up Hurt Locker, saw it was Mark Boll, and
oh,
thought,
man,
he's
oh,
good.
He's right.
Let's move.
Oh, man.
So I wasn't even listening the first time.
We're pathetic. Speaking of pathetic, let's get to some really, really terrible acting. It is time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize.
A couple weeks back, this was at our live year-end wrap party, as a matter of fact. Adam and I, along with producer Sam Van Hogeren and listeners Kenny and Jamie Meyer, who flew in for the occasion, we all massacred this scene.
Weapons!
Weapons.
You call.
Your challenge.
Who? Fate to call?
Rocks.
Belts.
Pipes.
Cans.
Bricks.
Bats.
Clubs.
Chains.
Bottles. Knives. Guns. What a coop full of chickens.
Who you calling chicken?
Every dog knows his own.
I'm calling you all chicken. Big tough buddy boys got to throw bricks, huh? Afraid to get in close? Afraid to slug it out? Afraid to use plain skin?
Not even garbage? That ain't a rumble.
Who says?
You said call weapons.
A rumble can be clinched by a fair fight. If you've got the guts to risk that, best man from each gang to slug it out.
I would enjoy to risk that. Okay, fair fight.
Oh, wait a minute. The commander say yes or no.
Fair fight.
Russ Tamblyn as Riff there, along with George Chakiris as Bernardo and Richard Boehmer as Tony in West Side Story from 1961, the screenplay by Ernest Lehman, based on the original musical book by Arthur Lawrence, and it was directed by Robert Wise.
Yes, it was. We got some great feedback, including this bit from Ed Savoy in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And Ed Savoy loves to come up with creative answers to Massacre Theater and creative explanations. And I even tried to listen to G. Officer Krupke again today. So
to get this
one of us could try to sing it and
you're
make it work.
You're prepared then, and I believe it's your turn.
Yeah, it probably is, but I couldn't do it. So either his whole timing is off or I'm just a musical idiot. But you could go ahead and read it anyway, what Ed wrote.
So here's what Ed provided. Dear Adam and Josh, guys, your go at glory clearly comes from the musical West Side Story. The tie comes from the lead-in and La La Land Talk. All three are from the musical genre block. Genre block, genre block, genre block. It's the genre block. Singing, West Side, and all the La La Talk.
I'm sure it matches
up perfectly.
You couldn't
make that work.
No.
Well, this is where I'd like to remind listeners that we have a voicemail number.
Yes.
And if you are going to create parody songs mm-hmm. like this and ask us to sing them,
yeah.
Just do it yourself.
I'm with you completely. Steph Wallace in Lombard, Illinois writes, I was so excited to attend the live rap party. When you started your Massacre Theater scene, I immediately knew you were doing West Side Story. As a high school lights and sound director, I was lucky to work on the show with my students several years ago, and these lines were still fresh in my head. Love the connection to the movie musical genre and La La Land with both West Side Story and La La Land's use of rich color. Props to Sam for his solid work as Tony, accent, costume, and all, as well as our out-of-town guests who did an awesome job for being called up on the spot. Had a great time hearing everyone's top scenes of the year, and I'm already looking forward to next year's wrap party. Thanks for another great year of film spotting.
Thank you, Steph. We also heard from Andre Cadeau from Charlottesville, Virginia. Regarding the performances, the one that stood out was Josh's. He sounded a lot like a Latino Charlton Heston.
And we've all heard that.
I can just imagine him watching Touch of Evil on repeat until he got that accent just right. How did Andre know my process?
Yeah, I guess so. More accent comments. Jim Bernstein in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who I know, longtime listener of the show and former coworker of mine, says in the area of critical commentary, Josh was correct. He wasn't going for Dracula with his Puerto Rican accent. Clearly, he was going for Boris Badenoff from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
No, Charlton Heston in Touch of
Latino
Evil.
Latino Charlton
Heston. We've established
Heston.
That.
By the way, Jim writes, I too was a part of massacring that same scene as a member of the cast of Louisville Seneca High School's senior play performed sometime in the previous century. We won't date you there, Jim. Thank you all who entered, and congratulations to our winner, Josh. Reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Anthony Gibson. He's from San Antonio, Texas.
Congratulations, Anthony. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's politically themed, political resistance.
Yeah, I would say
movie
resistance themed. Maybe.
Sure. Massacre Theater. And this was a first, I think, here in the history of the show. Josh just asked me off air if I'm prepared to cry.
Well, how method do you want to get here? Do you need to be punched,
I'm not like Sam.
Pinched?
I don't come wearing the costume of the actor I'm trying to portray. But hey, if you want to pinch me, slide on over.
That's all right. Let's just see if you could pull it off.
I don't think I can. There's a lot of pressure here now. So, you know,
we should probably give a few more clues.
What else can we say?
This is kind of obscure. Formative for you.
Yes.
Like many films of this era, I have.
One you missed?
I think I walked past it playing on a TV once.
Okay.
Because I have vague memories of a few of these scenes.
Meanwhile, they played it on HBO.
This scene is not convincing me I missed anything.
Probably not. But this is one of those films that I probably saw 100 times as a kid.
And we're combining your part.
That's true.
Is going to combine two, shall we say, iconic actors.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Iconic from their time period.
I'm very curious how you're going to meld them and cry. Okay, let's get to it.
I'm probably going to play a Russian vampire like you did with West Side Story. So I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
What happened, Dad? Why are you here? What'd they do?
Doesn't matter. One way or another, one reason or another, we're all gone. It's all gone. Remember when you used to go in the park and play, and I used to put you on the swings, And both of you are so damn little.
I remember all of it.
Well, I ain't going to be around to pick you up when you fall now. Both of you got to take care of each other now.
We'll never see you again, Dad.
Yes, you will. I don't want to hear that.
What happened to Mom? Dad, where is she?
We can't afford to be crying anymore now. I don't want either one of you to ever cry for me again. Don't ever do it. Not as long as you live. Y'all get going now. Get out before they find you.
And
scene. Was I too lively?
You were lacking in all charisma. That was amazing.
I think I might have overdone it.
If you know what film we just massacred, and I don't know if it's possible to massacre this particular movie, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, February 20th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. Nice crying.
Yeah.
This week's top five Adam political resistance movies is certainly timely, but as you pointed out when the topic came up, it also gives us the chance to knock out one of the titles on our joint blind spotting list, which we came up with on episode 528, so a while ago now. Somehow, yes, neither of us had seen 1966's The Battle of Algiers from director Gillo Pontecorvo. A description of the setting and the plot will make clear why the film, like our top five list, is also timely. The Battle of Algiers takes place during the Algerian War of the 1950s as France's occupying forces try to root out a network of militant cells seeking Algerian independence. Most of this is experienced through the eyes of Ali Lapointe, played by Brahim Hajjaj. A young Algerian who is sent to juvenile prison at the beginning of the film, joins the National Liberation Front when he's released and rises to the top ranks of the independence movement. We'll get to the movie's relevance to today's world, which is both a point of fascination and I think something to mourn in a lot of ways. But let's start by setting politics aside for the moment and consider the Battle of Algiers as it relates to film history rather than political history. Again, released in 1966, the movie struck me as the child of two mid-century cinematic movements, Italian neorealism and the French New Wave.
Hmm.
So when you consider the film's striking form, Adam, did you see the influence of one over the other? Both of those movements were political in their own ways. But in terms of the filmmaking, whose kid is this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you can definitely see parts of both parents here in the child. I don't know, when I think of Italian neorealism, whether it's La Terra Trema or it's Open City or Paisan, another film from Rossellini, I, of course, think about film shot on location. There's no sets. There's no extra lighting. These films usually star non-stars, often non-professionals. Sometimes you'll get one or two stars, but they are playing parts very different from what they're known for. And of course, the subject matter, it's all about working class people, disenfranchised people on the fringe. And there isn't a lot in terms of added drama or melodrama, often very slice of life movies and maybe less narrative driven. Now, those, of course, aren't traits that apply to every single Italian neorealist film. It's not as if there were some hard and fast conventions that they laid out like Dogma 95. And a lot of people argue, of course, that really it was a movement that was more about politics than it was aesthetics anyway. But that said, those are some of the common characteristics in those movies. And Battle of Algiers checks all of those boxes for the most part, even as high as the stakes are here with this movie. I think about a sequence like the one where we see the Algerian women, three of them, going through checkpoints with bags that have bombs in them. And as we come to find out, they are taking them to very high-profile public locations where there are a lot of French civilians.
Yeah, the European sector, really.
Exactly. And they are going to leave these bombs there. And we know a lot of innocent people are going to die. And we're on the edge of our seats. But Pontecorvo is incredibly restrained. He doesn't do anything at all during the sequence to artificially heighten the tension. And more than anything, this is a film that's a procedural. You spend as much time, much to my surprise, with Colonel Mathieu, who's the head of the French paratroopers who are called in when this thing really escalates, as we do Ali Lapointe, the head resistance fighter. And there are no heroes here. There are no causes that are ultimately romanticized. There's really just the consequences and the conditions of fighting the battles that these two sides are fighting. That all said, Josh, I really do think it's more New Wave than it is Italian neorealism, because if I think about what the basic tenet is, if you will, of New Wave films, utilizing the full scope of cinema, experimenting with the camera and editing, and this sense on the viewer's part that you're always aware that you're watching a movie. And I really think that that applies more than anything to this film. And it's maybe even a little bit ironic, because I read today that Cahiers du Cinéma, which was this pioneering critical magazine, right, that wrote about all these French New Wave films and featured many French New Wave directors and critics, they loathed The Battle of Algiers, apparently mainly on moral grounds. But this is a movie that does something no neorealism film would do that I can think of. It opens out of sequence, right? It shows us actually something that happens later in the film, and then we eventually get up to speed and come back to that part. You've got that newsreel approach with a voiceover, and yes, that does happen in some neorealist films, but it's clearly artifice to make something seem like it's newsreel footage. The way the camera moves, we start a lot of scenes in motion, and it kind of struck me almost as if we were just dropping in on history unfolding. It's in process already, and the camera is often handheld, and it's shaky, but we'll get tracking shots. And use of freeze frames, zooms, these large-scale sequences that are shot with telephoto lenses, and you're at a distance, but because of the lens, you feel like you're right in the middle of it. And even a scene, Josh, like the one early on where the guy who the film opens on, the Algerian resistance fighter who does betray some key information after he's been brutally tortured, of course, he turns to face the camera in close-up after he's had to put on French military clothes. Really, I mean, making it explicitly clear that he's one of them now, having betrayed his side and his people. And there's just layers of faces behind him. Pontecorvo layers about 10 people all crowded into that close-up behind him, and it makes it really haunting. Like, they're his jury, and they're judging him just like we're judging him. So all of those elements, again, the elaborate staging, the scale of these huge set pieces, and the music, too. Morricone.
Yes.
Morricone's score and the sound design overall, with some Algerian drumming, and there's gunfire and car noises and all these different elements that really make up this soundscape. Those are things that remind me more of a French New Wave filmmaker who's really pushing the envelope as to someone who's just trying to ostensibly capture life.
But yeah, the movie is alive in a way that I associate with the French New Wave. Not to say that Italian neorealism isn't, but there's just this vibrancy to it that you captured well in your descriptions there. Maybe the one thing I'd add to the Italian neorealism elements, and I'm thinking of movies I'm more familiar with, like maybe Bicycle Thieves or Umberto D, is the attention paid to architecture. These alleyways and the courtyards, really, it's crucial in helping us understand how those things can form social structure as well, which of course is what this movie is largely about, the social structure that's in tumult here. But the French New Wave touches I appreciated were some at the very beginning, when the French paratroopers are going to invade this home in the Muslim quarter. And we get these jump cuts behind the soldiers as they're parading up the alley. And that's something that, although this is thought of as a docudrama first and absolutely has those elements, if you were going to commit to that consistently, you wouldn't put those cuts in there to jar us, right? To increase this sense of dislocation and unease is what it does. But it also, as you said, makes us aware that we're watching a movie. So yeah, it was really fascinating to match those different influences and see how Pontecorvo is combining both of them. Now, to go back to the faces, I mean, I think that is the key to unlocking one of the main questions, and one of the reasons this movie was banned for, 5 years in France after its release, is what side is this movie on, if we have to determine that, right? If you pay attention to where the camera goes to, and in particular the characters' faces. I'm going to give you three instances that spell it all out for me. One's at the beginning when there are four people hiding from those invading paratroopers behind a false wall. The camera pans slowly without a cut from one to the other. There's a child, two men, and a woman, and just pauses. And right away in the opening moments of the film, and I think the torture sequence does this too.
For sure.
But here there's more of a focus on the face. These are human beings, right? These are not an other people, an unfamiliar group that we should be afraid of. No, these are individual human beings. Now, go to that flashback you mentioned, which is from Ali's youth, before he's arrested, the day he's arrested, actually. It's for gambling on the streets. He runs from the police, gets into an altercation with a French expatriate, I'm assuming. And the crowd.
That's the other shot.
Surrounds,
that mirrors that one with the guy at the beginning. The faces
with
behind
the faces.
Him.
Yep. Yeah. The crowd surrounds him. They start beating on him, these French civilians. And here the camera doesn't pause to take in their faces. They're a blur. Mm-hmm. There's this faceless mask of hatred. One more then is of French faces. And you talked about it when these women plant the bombs in the cafe is one location. What
the
does
young
the camera
boy,
do at
all
some
the
point?
Innocent faces.
Pauses to look at the innocent faces. So however you want to – the movie is deeply political but elementally humanist is what I would argue. And you can see how that might be purposefully missed by the powers that be at the time. But looking back on it decades later, I think you can't describe it as anything else but that.
Another way that we see that balance and that objectivity, if you will, is in the use of music where we have watched – this Algerian FLN, the movement, mow down a lot of police officers. And I will say I was thinking about who those police officers were and who their family members were, and they're kind of just taken out very dispassionately. And we don't, the camera doesn't make us have a lot of sympathy for them. And then there is a moment where there's an explosion in that Muslim quarter, in the Kasbah, and we see, and it's all wordless, it's just music, we see all of the victims being taken out and being laid out on the ground, and a lot of them are young children. Mm-hmm. And the music switches there to something it's never used up to that point in the movie that's a much more orchestral, much more somber, emotional piece of music. And right away you're thinking, okay, well, this is making us really feel, which of course we do, but it's really making us feel for these particular victims, whereas we haven't cared much about any of the French victims up to this point. But then when we get those bombings and we get those sequences where those faces and those French innocents, if you will, if you want to make the distinction between the people who are just going about their lives versus the people that are part of the oppressive force, when that bomb goes off and there are those casualties, the exact same music plays. So Pontecorvo does balance it out and make us feel for both sets of very innocent victims. But one of the things the movie made me really think about, and this is maybe less a criticism of the film or about the film and more just, I think, a fascinating and provocative question, this notion of a filmmaker trying to be objective. I think a lot of us these days, we know that there's something inherently fraudulent about anybody trying to be objective. You can't help that you are going to be subject to your own biases and prejudices. And the best way usually to deal with that is to acknowledge them as opposed to trying to be this dispassionate, objective observer. And so we get here, Pontecorvo very clearly trying to provide as much of a neutral perspective as he can on it. And I wonder, would it actually be better so far as an exchange of ideas goes, or if we're in a quest for the truth, would it not be better to not have a film that tries to walk the line of neutrality, no matter how well you do it? Would it not be better to instead have, let's say, if you could just do whatever you wanted, have two films, one completely explicitly told from the Algerian perspective.
Sort of the Eastwood approach with Iwo Jima and
maybe, and one,
or,
completely told from the perspective of the French, whether it's Colonel Mathieu and the military or it's the civilian side or both. And in this case, the film did originate with a screenplay by the actor who plays Jafar, one of the other resistance leaders. He's basically playing a version of himself, and he wrote the initial screenplay before Pontecorvo took it and made it into that more neutral perspective. But it just made me think about that. Which one is actually, quote unquote, better if you could have both of them.
Well, here's maybe where its resonance to today comes into play. And first, I should probably say, you know, I feel the film does ultimately fall on the side of the Algerians.
Yeah. It's impossible not to root for the oppressed.
Well, and it falls on it falls on the side of history too, right?
Yes.
So that comes into play. But yeah, would two polemical films taking the opposite sides, I think those would be easier to dismiss.
Yes.
Then maybe a movie that tries to do something more along these lines. Now, that having been said, one of the tragedies of thinking about the Battle of Algiers now is that this movie came out 35 years before 9/11,
mm-hmm.
the attacks on the World Trade Center, and gave a cinematic blueprint, essentially, for how Western oppression in the Muslim world could lead to radicalization and terror.
Yep.
The U.S. had it.
Yeah.
Had it in their hands. And even not only was little heed paid mm-hmm. to something like this, but in the years after 9/11, official policy has been to do the exact same things
right.
that we see in this film. So I'm undermining my argument, I guess, that a movie that tries to paint the whole picture for people
right.
has more value because it clearly has not been heeded by the powers that
be
in the years since.
Yeah, no. And the fact is we hear conversations about profiling Muslim people in this film that are conversations we're having right this moment.
It's crazy.
And it has conversations about torture that echo things that we've been arguing about for at least the last 15 years in this country.
So the torture thing is interesting because I remember when Zero Dark Thirty came out, a mm-hmm. film we both appreciated,
yes.
for similar reasons, I think, trying to walk some sort of line being something of a docudrama, probably
yeah.
less than this, but taking on that form to a degree. And when the controversy erupted as to whether this film was endorsing torture because it supposedly showed that it had a certain effectiveness, right? Mm-hmm. You know, watching the Battle of Algiers now, I feel like Zero Dark Thirty is even more blatantly anti-torture than I thought it was
really?
Then, because it uses a lot of the same tactics that this film does, that mm-hmm. Pontecorvo does, in acknowledging its use and also at the end of the day recognizing its sheer awfulness and
right.
inhumanity.
Even though it's successful in both
in
cases.
In this particular instance.
Yeah, that doesn't
in the
justify
battle,
it.
Exactly. And I feel like that is what the Battle of Algiers leaves us with. It does not leave us with it in a polemical way
mm-hmm.
or in an op-ed way, which is what I think some of Zero Dark Thirty's detractors wanted. But that's
yeah.
not art. That's not necessarily cinema, which is what we're getting here.
Yeah. In that interest, though, of balance and in trying to make here a French oppressor, if you will, a military paratrooper, the colonel, not make him seem just like a monster, not make him any more vilified than he needs to be. Okay, but imagine, Josh, imagine a scenario today where any government official from any government whatsoever gets up in front of the media to talk about a terrorist, someone who's very clearly a terrorist, and says something along the lines of, well, he's a man of principle,
yeah.
and I disagree with him. But I respect his principles. That's mind-boggling.
But isn't that part of this character's insidiousness, is that he then acts like they're playing a fair game when behind closed doors he's actively advocating and employing torture.
Right.
And
I didn't
somehow
feel like he really shirked from it, though, honestly. I mean, he obfuscates a little bit, but then when he's really pressed on it, he says it works. And he points out, and this is the thing that's so fascinating, he rationalizes what he does in a way that we can question or disagree with. But he says, at the end of the day, if my job is to protect French interests in Algiers, and that's why we're here, and all of you questioning me right now about torture all want us to be in Algiers, well, you can't have it both ways. The only way we're going to get to stay here and remain in control is if we employ tactics like
yeah.
this. So he does, as horrible as that is, he does put that back on the people questioning him, and he makes us as audience members question that as well.
He's just doing his job.
He is just doing his job. But again, further complicating that, Josh, is before you can write him off, he does point out he's one of the people that fought the Nazis. They resisted
yes.
the Nazi government in France.
Yeah,
these
the
aren't
irony
just
of including
people.
That
right.
detail.
These paratroopers aren't just horrible oppressors that want to keep the Algerian people down. So there are lots of layers to everything here in this movie. And I do think that's what makes it a film that so many people who listen to the show who appreciate it told us we had to see it. And at this point, fair to say, we both are very grateful that we finally took the plunge and crossed this one off our blind spotting list. Better late than never, Josh. The Battle of Algiers is available via Criterion Collection Blu-ray, has a host of extra features on that disc that I look forward to checking out at some point. And of course, you can get it as well via various streaming platforms.
Let's move from 1966 to 1970. Our review of Tristana, the sixth film in our Luis Buñuel marathon, is next. Stay with us. إلى أيها الظالم المستبد حبيب الظلام عدو الحياة سخرت بأنات شعب ضعيف وكفك مخضوب من دماء وسرت تشوه سحر الوجود وتبذر شوك الأسى في رباة الرماد اللهيب ومن يبذر الشوك يجري الجراح تأمل هنالك إني حصدت رؤوس الورى زهور الأمل.
Well, after finally getting to that long list of very generous donors that had built up over the holiday season, it's a much smaller list this week, but we'll get to those names and some thank yous in a moment. We did want to take a second to acknowledge our featured artist this week, appropriately, Algeria's Souad Massi from her 2015 album. I should make you pronounce this. If you can do Joe, the director whose name I don't even attempt, then, well, I'm going to let you do it. Josh, go for it.
El Muta Kalimunan.
Sure. Okay.
You're convinced?
I'm convinced.
That's all that matters.
In parentheses afterwards, Sam wrote Masters of the Word. I'm assuming that's the translation. That's a lot easier to say. More information about Souad Massi is at facebook.com/Souad.Massi. One of our donors we want to thank this week, Michael C. in Pittsburgh, and a new gold-level donor, Chris C. in Bakersfield, California. We also have a new $10 a month donor, Jared M. Hernandez. He's in San Luis Obispo, California. Is it San Luis or San Luis Obispo?
I've always meant to look that up.
Yeah, I have too.
Which means it's probably wrong.
It's probably San Luis Obispo. Anyway, here's Jared.
I've done a year of free listening, and since I'm still listening, I guess that means I like this show you guys put on. You remain my number one go-to podcast. My only request is that you gentlemen consider doing a Latin film marathon and explore these three great films. The double feature, Nosotros los Pobres, Ustedes los Ricos, that's We the Poor, You the Rich. It stars the greatly talented Mexican actor Pedro Infante, and then Maria Candelaria, directed by Emilio Fernandez. Love the show. Keep on keeping on. P.S. I literally have no idea what you guys look like. So in my mind, Josh sounds like he wears glasses and dresses sophisticatedly. Maybe he wears a tie and dress shirt every day, a real high school chess player type.
So that's mostly accurate. I mean, you don't wear glasses or a tie ever except in our last live show. But otherwise, I think of you as kind of a really cool high school chess player.
Well, thank you. The live show and I think Christmas Eve were the two times I wore a tie last year. So
yeah.
That's maybe not quite so accurate. All right, here's you. Adam sounds like the exact opposite.
This is so dead on.
You probably wear loose jeans, sandals, and perhaps no shirt. I also imagine you with a hairdo like Joaquin Phoenix in Inherent Vice. I have no idea. You'll have to confirm if this is true or not. Also, am I the only one that thinks that Michael Phillips sounds like Jeff Goldblum?
You're definitely not.
Right.
We have heard that a lot over the years. I'm sure he's heard that a lot over the years. And let's take a moment to congratulate him. He was honored this past weekend in L.A. by the African American Film Critics Association.
Very cool.
He got the Roger Ebert Award. And I was actually really grateful and honored to be part of the video. I got to tape a little thing. I assumed, honestly, that they would leave me out and I'd be on the cutting room floor.
Well,
because Michael sent me a nice note.
Okay.
So
all right, good.
Either he's just being really nice and he felt bad that I ultimately was left on the cutting room floor, or I actually made the cut.
Let's go back to your description here.
Yeah.
For one thing,
I mean, it's like you're looking
always,
at that.
You've always worn
That's
a
true.
Shirt, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
You pretty much wear a tie every day.
I do.
So
we should switch?
I think we need to switch here.
Well, I'd love to imagine me with a hairdo like Joaquin Phoenix
that's
and
pretty,
Inherent
that
Vice.
Part's pretty accurate.
Never going to happen, but a Platinum Club donor, Tom Freeman in Santa Monica, California. And we do want to thank the Right Reverend Robert Lewis. He's in Damascus, Maryland. He sent us a couple boxes, went to the P.O. box. It had been a little while since I was there, and he had a couple gifts. I think he was just cleaning out his office, and he came across a couple things that he picked up for us.
Could
and
be.
I didn't know what you got because I didn't open your mail, but I opened my box and I got not only the DVD Patton, because Robert listens closely to the show and knows that that is a blind spot for me and it remains a blind spot for me, but he also got me, how about this, The Vision Volume 1, which I think it was in a hot mic segment at the end of the show, but
proves he's a close listener.
Yeah, I went on about Tom King and his series, The Vision, and that volume one, the first six installments in that comic book. Totally new to me and blown away by it. Can't recommend it enough. He got me that set, but signed by Tom King.
Very nice.
Who was also a Film Spotting listener, as we mentioned at the time, and I'm pretty sure we're going to have him on at some point this year. But how thoughtful. And we really appreciate it. What did you get, Josh?
Well, mine are both my DVDs are in their cellophane wrapping, so if they were just sitting around his office, he never got to them himself. But blind spots for me as well, Rio Bravo. I know that hurts Sam that I still have not seen Rio Bravo. And MASH, which I just got tonight and was one of those blind spots I wanted to fill for our political resistance films. Mm-hmm. I'll be able to do it a little late, but now
you can do it.
I can do that. Thanks,
one
Robert.
Last bit of fan mail here, a postcard. It's not often we get postcards, but Bruno sent us this note.
With all the holiday craziness, I haven't been able to catch up with the last couple of episodes. I do hope I'm not too late with this little Christmas gift, which I consider one of the best Buñuel movies, and sincerely hoped you could include in your ongoing marathon. Love from the beautiful Fribourg, Switzerland, and signed Bruno Hunziker. P.S. I can't wait for you to butcher my last name.
I thought that was probably pretty close,
well,
but what do I know?
Especially because Bruno's handwriting, it's okay. It's better than mine, but, you know, not pristine.
Okay, so we could blame him?
Yeah, we could blame the handwriting. He also says, P.P.S., have you finally watched Dr. Zhivago?
He missed that episode.
Have you? Bruno, I think you're a little more behind than the last couple of episodes.
Yeah, blind spotting, what, year and a half ago? A couple summers ago. It wasn't just this past summer. The summer before.
Yeah, I think it's been over
a
year.
So, yeah, you can listen to that show, Bruno, if you are curious. And the DVD he sent was Los Olvidados, the Buñuel film. Did not make the cut for
an
the
earlier
marathon.
An earlier documentary is that? No?
Why do you have to ask me that?
The marathon isn't over, so we're not experts yet.
I'll just Google that real quick, and Sam will edit it, and we'll sound like we know what we're talking about. But thank you very much for the DVD and the postcard. A no-cost way you can help the show, rate or review us on iTunes. The iTunes overlords do seem to pay attention to those kind of things, and we thank everyone who took the time to do it. Attack Gorilla, who wrote the Best Film Podcast. Thank you. Ed5464 didn't say the best, but he said, my favorite podcast. And he said, the best part is the host. They have great rapport. So we are faking it well here, Josh. And J. Bennett B., who says, they should write a book. I'd buy it and read it. Well,
I got one for you, J. Bennett B.
Josh has one for you.
Adam, I couldn't convince to be co-writer, but
yeah.
Movies Are Prayers, June 13th.
June 13th. There you go.
That's only a few months away.
I'm not involved, but I will hawk it here on the show.
Yes,
so
that's all I really expect. Why are you not also thanking ours, RSTX, HFU?
Well, I think you just nailed it.
And
why?
9872-9834-8949-8298-398-Kajilfa. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks to 9872.
Saturna, oye, ¿qué pasa? Mira esa calle. Y esta otra. ¿Cuál de las dos te gusta más?
La que usted quiera, yo no sé.
Yo prefiero esta, vamos.
Pues si le he de decir la verdad, a mí me gustaba más la otra calle.
Catherine Deneuve with Lola Gauss in a clip from 1970s Tristana. This is the fifth conversation we're having about Buñuel. We have one more to get to round out the marathon. This marathon is presented by Mubi.com, a curated online cinema that brings its members a hand-picked selection of the best independent, international, and classic films. Every day, Mubi's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. So Josh, after finishing Tristana and jotting down some notes, I wanted to see if there was something I was missing here, because Buñuel's films can be a challenge, let's put it that way. And I found Scott Tobias's review for the AV Club, and I started reading it, and I immediately became dismayed. And this often happens when I read really good critics, but in this case, it's for a different reason. Scott writes, "There are allusions to Spain under Generalissimo Franco and the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church, resonances specific to the narrow passages of Toledo, surrealist dream sequences along the lines of Buñuel's 1967 classic Belle du Jour, Freudianism run amok, and the director's expected skewering of bourgeois values and hypocrisy." So some of those things I picked up on because we've seen other films and I've seen other films from Buñuel prior to the marathon. Some of it I picked up on because it's right in front of you, but other stuff I didn't. And I thought, wow, I know Scott's smarter than me, but he really saw a lot in this movie that I didn't pick up on. And then he writes, "Some of those references are immediately graspable, others more obscure, which makes it fortunate that the Coen Film Collection, a promising upstart that debuted last month with Douglas Fairbanks' The Thief of Baghdad on Blu-ray, has given Tristana a Criterion-level treatment with liner notes, essays, and diaries, a visual essay, and a commentary track to put Buñuel's achievement into perspective." So he had a little bit of support there with those various resources. And I guess even though I don't see this film at all as his most difficult to follow, not even the most difficult to follow from this marathon, the surrealist stuff we started with would probably take that mantle. As I said, this film is still challenging. It's similar in some ways to Diary of a Chambermaid, where we have a young, seemingly innocent woman. In this case, she is very innocent, at least to start, as many Buñuel heroines are. She has been essentially raised by this gentleman, and he is her patron, her guardian, becomes a father to her very clearly when her mother passes away. Their relationship shifts and becomes a little bit more complicated as the film goes on. So with all of those different elements that Scott touched on and a whole lot more that we haven't touched on yet, what were you able to latch on to here, if anything?
Yeah, well, that goes back to what we said at the very beginning of this marathon, right? Is how do we prepare for these films? How much preparation should you do? It goes back to watching before the marathon, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which I would say is even more packed with references and connotations, particularly relating to Spanish political history that, you know, I just had no preparation for. So we've given ourselves the freedom, I think, to take these as we can. And it was with Unsha Nandalu, where you in particular just said, well, this is not really meant to mean anything in a lot of ways. So we shouldn't worry too much about it. So what did I latch on to? Well, I started with what we had last seen, Diary of a Chambermaid, and you touched on this too, with these heroines who come to take control of their own sexual power, identity, position in these men's world. This is particularly more in a man's world, I would say, than Diary of a Chambermaid.
And real quick, fair to say that in Diary of a Chambermaid, Jean Moreau's character, we can probably read into it that that was part of her objective. Coming from Paris, and she did have a bit of an agenda.
She came in knowing what to expect.
Deneuve is a blank slate.
Very much
she really discovers herself.
Yes. Although we should also say that she, both he and she are on good terms when she moves in with him. He, too, seems to have the best of intentions and wants to protect her innocence. And that transitions for him. And when it does, she's okay with it. You know, she's appreciative of this newfound adult attention that she is getting from him. And then after a year or two, maybe, and especially with the restrictions he puts on her, she gets a little bored and starts pursuing her own pleasure. Here's what I appreciated most about Tristana is the way it plays one long joke on Don Lope, played by Fernando Rey, who's in a number of other Buñuel films. Very funny here, I thought. And this is somewhat of a retort to, you know, Buñuel is – he's so far away from – Catholic repression when it comes to sexuality. But we can see him feeling around for, but what does the alternative mean? And here, there's almost a sense that uninhibited freedom for people can be a snake eating its own tail.
Yeah.
Because Don Lope gives a great justification for his own pursuit of pleasure. I love
a man of the principle.
I love the way he describes the Ten Commandments. That the ones involving sexuality, he thinks, well, Moses added those later, and the quote is for political reasons that don't affect me.
There you go. He can just discard them.
How nice would it be to say that about the things we just don't want to follow? So that's very funny at the beginning, and that of course all gets turned on him when Tristana says, okay, I'm going to follow you. I'm going to listen to your teaching. Mm-hmm. I'm going to live that way too. And it doesn't work. They can't both do it, because once she starts doing it, then he is no longer as free as he wants to be.
Yes.
So there was some nice comic interplay. He essentially goes from this Lothario to a clown. And you can trace this, I think, in how the film treats his handling of his mustache.
Right. Which literally, you know, it opens on him twirling his mustache.
It does, yes.
Which maybe seems a little too on the nose, but then, as we may discuss, he comes to be a character who, while highly flawed and someone we maybe come to not sympathize with that much, he's also not the complete scoundrel that we've seen Fernando Rey be as a character, as an actor in many other Buñuel films.
No,
he's someone who is, despite his hypocrisy, and all of Buñuel's characters are full of hypocrisy, he seems to be maybe the most principled and the most similar to Buñuel, or at least who Buñuel wants to be, than any of these other so-called villains.
He has his beliefs and he lives by them and he sticks to them. But yeah, the mustache is so great, because near the end, when he's become this, he ages so rapidly, right? When she starts living her own life, and then we get that great scene of him in a nightshirt, I think he is. And what is that he's wearing on his – it's like a mustache mask. Is he dyeing it there?
I thought what he was doing was probably like putting in shoe polish.
Yes. Yeah,
putting shoe polish into his graying beard.
Somehow.
He's trying to dye it.
And he just looks like a fool. So to watch that play, that shift happen, I enjoyed quite a bit. And I enjoyed the performances. Rey, as we mentioned. And then Deneuve is just – you know, we were talking before we got started here how sometimes character motivations are left on the cutting room floor or not even bothered with in Buñuel. Yet, Deneuve manages to make a transition from this innocent to, really, you could describe her as a feisty feminist who develops an eye for art in the middle section.
Yeah.
And then this third section, which we should get into because things take a really interesting turn.
They do.
She's this bitter and scarred woman. And those are three distinct portraits, yet we feel of the same person. It's quite a performance.
Yeah, it is. And I think the pleasures you derived are pretty much the same ones I did. And I mentioned how this character might be closer to Buñuel in some ways from the other types of antagonists we're used to seeing. And certainly you seeing Fernando Rey play. If you think about something like The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, he is the character who typifies sort of bourgeois complacency and entitlement, and we can't wait for him to get his comeuppance.
Yeah.
And then in something like Viridiana, which isn't part of our marathon, but a Buñuel film I really, really love, that's when a nun comes to live on the estate with a similar type of character, but he's much more blatantly lascivious and a terrible human being who's going to do whatever it takes to get what he wants. And here we have a guy who, whether he fully lives it or not, and that's even debatable, he'll at least espouse socialist rhetoric. Right. And he'll talk about how you have to defend the weak. And he's one of those people who's made a living out of being an enemy of injustice. Now, what I love is the way Buñuel will subtly undercut that by having him walk out of a big meal with one of his gentleman friends. Mm-hmm. And they'll be commenting on how much they just ate at this lunch. Meanwhile, they're walking right by a guy with crutches who's holding a sign and clearly needs help.
Yeah.
And they don't help him. And then there's a moment earlier in the film where he's with Catherine Deneuve's Tristana and someone runs by. He's just stolen a bag.
Yeah.
He runs to the left. And then the police come by and they say, "Where did he go?" And he points him to the right. And she's shocked and says, "Why did you do that?" And his explanation is that he's this defender of the weak and that person needs the help. And so, of course, he's going to assist him and he's going to send the authorities the wrong way. But the way it plays out is much more like he's actually just
justifying
the type of guy.
He did.
Yeah, he actually just really kind of enjoys sticking it to people in power, which is a little bit different than doing it because you care so much.
You're protecting the weak, right?
Right.
Although he makes the reference too that something like the police are always the strong.
Yes.
And there is that scene with the police that are facing down, I believe, their workers. They're very young. So at first I thought they were kids, but I think they're blue collar workers. And that's just kind of some background political element that's going on, as there often is in Buñuel's films. Yeah, this guy's he's a scoundrel, maybe, is the way to describe
that's exactly
him.
You know, the word. And Fernando Rey's the best scoundrel
really
in cinema
is.
History.
Yeah, he really
like
is.
No one's better. And like so many of these Buñuel scoundrels, he is trying to – first, he idealizes completely her perfect innocence, as he calls it. And then – he can't help himself from trying to corrupt that somewhat. And he constantly is talking about protecting her as an honest woman. But as so happens in these cases, that ends up backfiring against him and actually does corrupt her and him along the way. And so that is something that stood out to me as well, Josh, is if I was going to try to sum this movie up or draw some kind of conclusion about what I think psychologically, I don't know about Freudian. I didn't study psychology in school, so I don't know a ton. But what I do know very clearly is this movie plays with this dynamic very explicitly between him as her father figure and as her husband.
Yes.
So he starts off as a dad, very much there to take care of her, to keep her sheltered from the world that's going to try to corrupt her. And in the process, then he becomes her lover. And in doing that and becoming that more husband figure, what we see happen is you can't be both. Boone Wells seems to be saying that there are two roads. And this plays out not only in that scene with those roads that she returns to at one point with another character, but she talks at one point in the film about how you can always make a choice. Two pillars, whatever it is, they're distinct. And you can make that distinction. You can decide you have a preference for one over the other. Well, what this movie kind of shows us is that you cannot be both of those things simultaneously, that one will ultimately corrupt the other. And so what plays out is this really fascinating psychological battle where every time he seems to be becoming more frail and weak, it's because she's becoming stronger. Mm-hmm. It's like she's taking all the power from him.
Yeah.
It's emboldening her. And you see it, as you said, in the way he looks and how white his hair becomes. He becomes ghostly, where meanwhile she becomes this radiant figure. And Catherine Deneuve's always radiant, but the color in her face and the makeup and her hair and the way she moves and the way she talks, all that power comes through. But the more he's able to assert himself and have that power, he's sucking it from her. And so they can't exist together without there being those two different paths to take.
And then there's another power shift in the final third.
Right.
Where she develops, is it a blood disease, I believe, is
yeah,
something
blood poisoning,
that
the doctor
leads
says.
To her having one of her legs amputated. And then all of a sudden, you know, I feel the movie start – it already is very Buñuelian, but we start really falling into some – body horror touches mm-hmm. that have always been a part of his cinema we've seen. And the dream imagery becomes a little more ghastly. Early on, she has a dream of Don Lope's head as the clapper of
yeah.
the church bell mm-hmm. knocking back and forth. It's his decapitated head, and that returns. And then there's this really sinister sequence just about near the end of the film where he's having hot chocolate with his buddies in the separate room, and she's on her crutches just pacing back and forth up and down the hall. And Buñuel doesn't do a ton with the camera.
No, he doesn't.
I think
here.
we can say throughout most of his films, but the way he captures this pacing of a tracking backwards as she approaches, I mean, it is scary.
It is.
She's
yeah.
scary here. And I just love how the movie makes that turn as well. I don't quite know what to make of it, but I am haunted by the knock of her wooden crutches on the tile
sure.
floor that just keeps going, repeating as they're having their innocuous conversation with their hot chocolate.
Yeah. When we do our Buñuel Marathon Awards, we're accepting any title suggestions
yeah,
for those awards
those
at
yet.
This point. But I doubt this is going to be my favorite scene or moment, but so far, the moment from any Buñuel film that gave me the most pleasure in the moment was watching Don Horatio, who becomes Tristana's lover, go to face a weakened Don Lope in the street. And Don Lope takes umbrage with this younger, more vital man stealing his woman and having an affair with her. And so he does what an honorable man would
that's all,
do.
That's all he really does
yeah.
do, too, is take umbrage.
He slaps him. He takes umbrage and then he slaps
yeah.
him across the
yeah.
face. He might even do the double slap. I can't
I
remember. And so what's the response from Don Horatio? He slugs him.
Uh-huh.
He punches him good in a way that knocks him flat to the ground and needs help from two men who happen to walk by to get back up and go home with his tail between his legs. And I think I loved it so much, partly because you just like to see this Fernando Rey character get it a little bit. But there is something, at least this is my rationale for it, there is something about Buñuel's films where they're all about sexual desire and they're about these primal instincts. Mm-hmm. All these characters succumb to their primal instincts, and yet they're so intellectual that you rarely see characters engage in those real primal activities.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
At least in the films when you
see, so when you see a character go, you know what, we're not just going to do this gentleman thing where you slap me across the face and I act like I'm all upset about it and we have an argument or I slap you back. He punches him good. And it was very gratifying somehow in that moment, that release of the violence that comes through in that moment in Tristana. So fair to say another Buñuel film we enjoyed. We were talking a little bit about this off air. I don't think betraying anything to say that these films have been interesting and we have appreciated almost all of them. I think less enamored by Robinson Crusoe than you were, fair to say.
Yeah, I like that one.
You like that one. But we've appreciated all these films. I don't know that we've seen one yet that we feel like is for us truly a masterpiece or a film we're really passionate about seeing.
I was saying Un Chien Andalou, the first one for me is a masterpiece, but it was almost easier to access because it's so purely surrealist that we're not required to have any sort of attachment to characters.
Yes.
And I don't know that Buñuel wants us to really have attachment to characters, but when we're presented with people like Tristana, it's our instinct just because of the majority of the films we watch.
They represent something.
Yeah,
they represent ideas and the frailties of all humanity. That definitely comes through in these characters. We'll see how we react and whether or not we use the M word to describe our last film in the marathon, 1977's That Obscure Object of Desire. Next week, though, is The Wickening, when we're doing the John Wick feature.
We need to apply all of our intellectual
prowess, our critical faculties to John Wick. So we're going to put the Buñuel marathon off for a week. In 2 weeks, we'll get to That Obscure Object of Desire, Buñuel's final feature. That film is available for rental and streaming. Check our marathons page for details about that. A reminder that our Buñuel marathon is sponsored by Mubi and Josh. This week, they are celebrating the birthday of Derek Jarman, one of Britain's groundbreaking visionary directors. They're showing three of his fabulously iconoclastic films, starring Tilda Swinton, Laurence Olivier in his last screen role, and cinema's most memorable, Color Blue. Blue is one of those experiences because, if I'm remembering it correctly, we watched it in a film class I took as an undergrad, British Film and Thatcherism, and you really are just staring at a blue screen the entire time.
How long is it?
I want to say like feature length.
Okay.
So there's Blue.
But you have to see it, though.
You do.
You still have to see it. You can't just be told that's what it is.
No.
No, you got to experience it.
You got to experience it. Blue, The Last of England, and War Requiem are all available now at Mubi, along with a film decidedly unlike Blue, Black Sunday.
This is from wildcard Italian genre maestro Mario Bava. He's perhaps best known for this horror film that came early in his career, also known as The Mask of Satan.
That's right.
I understand. The real star in this one, I hear, is unpredictable actress Barbara Steele.
So not Black Sunday, the 1977 terrorist plot to blow up the Super Bowl, directed by John Frankenheimer. This is a horror film.
Different one, yes.
Okay. Mubi always has 30 wonderful films for you to watch, all for just $4.99 a month. Plus, you can use their mobile apps to download the films to watch offline. Film Spotting listeners can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting to redeem now. That's our show. Send comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. I am at Filmspotting. Josh is at Larson on Film.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, get in on the John Wick fun and vote in the current Film Spotting poll. John Wick, Sacred Cow, or False Idol. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both of those in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, The Red Turtle, Oscar nominated for Best Animated Feature and highly recommended.
Highly.
By Josh Larson. Out in wide release, 50 Shades Darker.
Highly recommended by Adam?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but
how did you not go to the press screening for this?
I skipped the press screening for 50 Shades Darker. It hurt. The Lego Batman movie one we're both highly anticipating, and of course, John Wick 2. Now, here in my notes, Sam has called it not the Wickening, but Wickapalooza. That is next week. Ooh, our blind cow review of John Wick, plus some thoughts on John Wick Chapter 2. If you have thoughts on John Wick, leave us a short voicemail, 30 seconds or so, and we may use it in next week's show. You do have to leave it, though, with your best Keanu Reeves impression. 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, who are a particular help to me with my top five this week. Special thanks also to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week comes from Algeria's Suad Massi. More information is at facebook.com/suad.massi. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I suppose we could do a little hot mics to warm up. Did you you saw Lion, so you've been making good, yeah, and catching up on some Oscar
stuff.
Well,
it was kind of Debbie's idea. She wanted to see it, and it was part of our Friday night. She was even up for a double feature on Friday night.
Put the mic up a little bit. Yeah.
There we go. And so we started with Trolls, as you saw, and we talked about.
Yeah. So are you not in at all on Trolls, or you just didn't think it was that great?
So it's – no, it has – there are some funny moments. Have you – you saw it, right?
No.
Oh, okay. There are these interludes that have an animate – like a felt animation aesthetic. I think it's still CG, you know, computer animation, but that are something different. But I am just so tired of these assaultive kids flicks, and it is – that through and through, but you know, purposefully. It means to be this like in your face, bright, bizarre, and people have embraced its bizarreness, but it's just I found it really wearying. I also am not, you know, the pop song covers in place of real music. That does nothing for me. I know it's got the JT song that's original, I guess, but yeah, it was a chore. So we followed that up with Lion, which I feel bad now about kind of dissing it on the last show when we were talking about the Oscars. You know, where did this thing come from?
I told you, everybody I know who's seen it says it's really
good. I know, I heard that too. But I expect, like I said, I expected it to be good. And it's better than that.
Okay.
You know, it's very – just the story, this true life tale, it could have been terrible, I guess is what I'm saying, in terms of wringing the emotions – mawkish, and it's not like I really think it handles it well. I'd be interested to hear how Slumdog Millionaire detractors take it, because I think maybe some of the problems they have with that, this movie could also be accused of, but I love Slumdog Millionaire, so those elements didn't bother me. I think both, you know, are true to the depiction of poverty without exploiting it, and also allow for some joy in the lives of kids in particular who might experience that. So the opening third, which is the Dev Patel character as a, I don't know, 5-year-old boy in this incredible story of getting separated from his brother, stuck on a train, ends up in Calcutta, has no idea where he is or where his family's from.
See, my heart's already palpitating.
Oh,
there's no way I can watch this movie.
Oh, Adam.
There's no way.
Yeah, it's wrenching, but I really don't think they wring it any more than they have to. And that is what I appreciate about it. And there's really some, you know, the imagery is very sophisticated, especially in the use of flashbacks. It nicely balances between being like beauteous for the sake of a travelogue, yet still recognizing that there is beauty here, or like really focusing on the poverty and you know, trying to again wring your emotions out of that. So yeah, it was a nice surprise. I thought it was quite good. So catch up with it if you can.
Yeah, I definitely intend to. I didn't really get to do much other than preparing for the show. I do only have about 25 minutes left in I Am Not Your Negro.
And let me guess, the running time's 72.
It really is under 90, yeah, I think. Right. So there's almost no excuse for it, but
worth it, because that was like
totally
at
without
my
question.
Pile at the end of the year, like towards the top. Get to this.
I think I had it at number one, and I think maybe Lion was two. So
yeah,
and absolutely needs to be seen. And I can absolutely understand why it got an Oscar nomination. Samuel L. Jackson, I think, does the voiceover narration, and it's really interesting because it doesn't really sound like him.
He's
and at
not
the same
doing
time,
Samuel Jackson.
No, he's not doing Samuel L. Jackson, and he's not really doing James Baldwin either, who has a really distinctive voice.
Okay.
But there is a sense of Baldwin in it, in the rhythm of his voice.
Okay.
And so it's just weird to hear Samuel L. Jackson. If you didn't know going in that it was him, and I just saw him do an interview about it, I don't think I would have picked out that it was Samuel L. Jackson.
So maybe he's doing it's almost a performance.
It is. Yeah. It is a bit of a performance, and it certainly fits in with so many other movies from this year in terms of being incredibly timely.
Yeah.
There's just no doubt about it on so many levels, and it's one I highly recommend so far. But I do have 25 minutes left, so we'll see if it only grows in my estimation after that. I didn't have much time either because we went back to Iowa City this week, and I took the two oldest kids. I had a concert to go see in Iowa City, and Holden is leaving for El Salvador in March.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah, Holden is going with Sarah's parents and some other extended family members who every year do this big mission to El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
So Holden's going on that, and they had a meeting. So we let him obviously go to the meeting that evening, actually, while I was at the concert. And so that's going to be interesting to see how that whole thing plays out.
How's he approaching it? Is he like all in, or is he like, okay, I'll give it a try?
He's a kid who wants to eventually work for the UN.
Right.
So,
and I know he's obsessed with like maps and geopolitical
stuff. He's very interested, but he's also a kid who has never known manual labor in his life. And it's not like he's coming from...
You don't have a mowing the lawn?
No. Oh, actually, I did. I started this past summer.
Well,
yeah.
Oh, he's ready then.
But I usually take the front and make him do the back. I mean, I'm helping the kid out. And it's not like he comes from incredibly rigid stock here, okay? I mean, you know, it's not like I've probably done a whole lot of manual labor either. So he's going to be working hard for a week.
That'll be great.
It's mostly a medical mission, but he will still be very busy. And obviously, he's not going to be living in the best of conditions. And,
right.
And that is going to be a shock to his system. So I feel for the kid, but I'm really excited for him, and he seems excited too. But yeah, I went and saw Dawes. So randomly, and this is what the point is, it's all random, but I just couldn't help but think of how crazy this was. On the way to the concert, my friend Matt went with me, who I've mentioned before, but the drummer in my band since junior high, my best friend since first grade, haven't hung out with him in a long time. And so he went to see Dawes with me at a theater, beautiful Englert Theater, old-fashioned theater that used to be a movie theater. It's where I saw Titanic and The Big Lebowski and a bunch of movies. And then they renovated it, and now they just do big events and concerts and things like that. And we were talking about Robbie Robertson, the musician from the band.
Mm-hmm.
He was on WTF. We're both fans of the band. And so I was just telling him how crazy it was hearing Robbie Robertson tell the story of how the band formed and how he got to be a musician. And it was all just based on randomness. It was sort of, you know, they were in a certain club and they saw this guy playing and they said, wow, we'd really like to have him in the band. And then they needed a bass player. And what do you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's Rick Danko. So they ask him, and like this incredible group of musicians that really did come together totally randomly. And you think if on a certain night they hadn't gone to that bar, they never would have seen
right.
him.
And yeah, it was rock proximity.
Yeah. Rock history would be completely different. And so we were talking about that. And then we met up with a couple Film Spotting listeners, Jason and Suzanne. And we were talking to them, and a little bit of the history of the show came up. And I mentioned how someone in 2005 in February handed me a magazine cover that explained what podcasting was. I'd
right.
never even heard the word at that point. And so we were talking about timing and how we started before iTunes even launched podcasting, and how fortuitous that was that we had 3 or 4 months of shows built up. And that's obviously what helped lead to us having an audience. And so we were imagining for a second if that person didn't see that magazine and didn't hand it to me and I didn't read it.
Right.
Because
You were not looking for,
no,
for this sort of
No, was not
thing.
Looking for yeah. anything like that. Podcasting had been around for 4 months or so at that point. I'd never heard the word. So how long would it have taken me to hear that word and to decide, oh, that's something we should try and call Sam and do it? Maybe we'd been completely thrown off and we didn't start a podcast until a year later or 6 months later and it would have been too late. So that came up. And then we go to the concert and Matt and I are sitting on an aisle. We have our own, we're in a section that's just four seats and we're on the aisle. And there's a guy next to me and a girl next to him who I didn't even look at, really. We didn't make any eye contact or anything. And then about 4 or 5 songs in, he got up to go to the bathroom or get a drink and he came back. And then like a minute later, he turns to me and he says, Adam? And I go, Joe? And it's Joe Harani, the guy I used to work with at my former job and who I did the radio show with at Iowa.
Really?
That was the forerunner to Film Spotting.
Holy
we did
cow.
We did Burn Hollywood Burn.
When's the last
weekly.
Time you saw him?
Well, I've stayed in touch with him via text. I'd probably texted him within the past 6 months. Like, I texted him when we got Klosterman on the show because I know he would really appreciate that. So I thought of him when that happened. But I haven't probably seen him in 5 years. And so for us to be randomly seated next to each other at a concert, it was crazy. So I don't know. It was just one of those bizarre circumstances, and the show was great. We've played Dawes on the show before, and they put on an amazing show. And this is the last thing I'll say about it, is that I always remember Greg Kot writing an article in the Chicago Tribune about writing a bad review of a U2 concert, and like Bono called him to complain about it. Because the article starts with him saying that, like, I'm on Lakeshore Drive when I get a call from Bono. So it stood out in terms of that sort of trope or conceit of a review. And Bono took issue with it, and he basically said, well, you didn't sell your new songs. You just basically got by on the reason everyone came there, but you have a new album out, and you didn't really do anything with those songs or play many of them or make them interesting. And Dawes has a new album out that I am really lukewarm on. I like about 3 songs. We played 2 of them on the show, and it just didn't – it hasn't worked for me.
Did they sell it?
They played like 6 tunes off the album, and 2 of them were probably – 2 of the best songs of the night.
Okay.
And now I love all 6 songs. Yes, they absolutely sold me. Like, over the course of the night, they just got better and tighter, and the crowd got more into it. And the fact that they sold me on these tunes, seeing them live.
Sure.
I give them a lot of credit.
It usually works that way.
Yeah.
So I don't know what was wrong with Bono
that
night.
If they were just going through their motions, though, maybe a little bit, I don't know that I would have gotten as into it. But they were into it. It was good. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.